Welcome to the Broken Patriot Podcast, episode 267. I'm your host, Eric Moore. With me once again is my semi-permanent co-host, CEO of Zega Financial, Jay Pestricelli. Jay, what's going on?
Catastrophe this week, Derek. The market went down. I don't even know. How do I survive this right now? It went down.
I saw the screen was red. I was like,
oh my god,
the screen. Is this broken?
Look, I don't want to make light of it because, you know, every major downturn starts with a slow downturn. But so I'll recognize that. But yes, down. Look, maybe we're going to take a little pause. Maybe it's pause time in the wonderful run that we've had so far. You know, it was nice. We got through like the end of the quarter. All our quarterly reports are going to look amazing. And then the market does its downturn. I hate it when it does the downturn with like 2 weeks to go in the quarter, then the quarterly reports are like, well, it could have been a little better. That's it. The March report is going to look great for clients in general, don't you think?
Yeah. Yeah, and not only that, but market shook it off. I mean, so I was watching that downturn, and I think we were messaging among the investment committee, and we were saying, you know, just obviously we saw the leg down, and most drops have been bought. Yesterday wasn't. Now, today was an update. One of the things I noticed, though, was, you know, high yield was basically flat yesterday. And that, to me, is always like, okay, if the market goes down and high yield is okay, one of them's wrong. You won't know until the next day. But, Jay, that I feel like if it was really, really going to be bad yesterday, we would have saw high yield spreads.
Right, but I think there was a little bit of a little flight to safety happening yesterday, right? So if you noticed, you know, it was concern over rates staying high, yet bonds still went up. So I think, you know, we always talk about high yield as a mix between what's going on in the treasury markets and investment grade and equities, right? So it's kind of a mix between the two. So I think there was a little flight to safety yesterday, which to me is like, we haven't seen that in a while, right?
No.
We're a day where rates are like, ooh, they're going to be up, yet bonds went up, right? So it was a little bit of, a risk off day yesterday, for sure.
Okay, I'm going to do a reenactment of what happened with Jay Powell and his fellow Fed members. They all got into a room. Okay, here's the reenactment. Ready?
Yeah.
I'm Jay Powell. Okay, guys. We're all going to go talk this week a lot. We're going to do media. Is it one hike? You know, really stressed, guys. Maybe we don't hike. Maybe it's one hike. The economy is really strong. All right, got it? All right, break. Everyone go. You go to Bloomberg. You go to CNBC. You go talk to New York Times. I mean, that's pretty much what happened this week. They're all talking.
Well, that's one of two tools they have, right? Change rates or talk about changing rates. So they're just exercising one of their tools. Look, we're not going to get a Fed meeting to what, May 1st, right? So we got a little ways to go before we hear from them officially, right? Inflation numbers are coming next week. PCE was that last week? So and that wasn't so bad. Like, I don't know. Like, they're just that's all they got. They could talk about doing something with rates, or they could do something with rates. That's all they can do. So they're exercising that muscle. That's what they're doing. They're just getting out there talking about it. And you're right. It was a coordination about maybe we don't change. Can we just pivot to today? Like, can we talk about like today, what today had, like the reaction afterwards? Or you want to stick with yesterday's big red bar?
No, let's talk. We're recording this on Friday. Today was, everything's cool. Everything's great.
It's fine. Marco's up over 1%. S&P was up over 1%. But it felt like with the way that the jobs number was, and I know we're going to talk about it a little bit, it felt like with the way the jobs number was, it should have been a better day. That was a Goldilocks jobs report, in my opinion.
All right, let's get right into it since you brought it up. Right. We'll pivot to that. So, household survey, and that means they're calling people. I don't know. Do they call people on their cell phones? I have no idea. So they call people up and they say, hey, do you have a job? Yeah, I do. All right, great. Click. Do you have a job? No. All right, cool. Well, not cool that you don't have a job, but have you looked for work in the last 4 weeks? Nah. Okay, you're not in the labor force. So, you know, so just to bring everybody up to speed on that. Jay, though, 498,000 more people were employed, 29,000 less people were unemployed. The size of the civilian non-institutional population, that's the size of the population that could potentially work, that are not otherwise incarcerated, I guess, right? Is the otherwise you're busy or whatever. You know, that rose and the labor force participation rose. So, yeah, like to me, if you're seeing this, like forget about interest rates. If you're like, is the economy doing good or not? Oh, more people are getting jobs. The size of the labor force is growing and unemployment went down. Like what's not to like about that?
This was all beautiful, right? That was all really good information. And then from the wage side, wage increases weren't out of control. They were kind of, they matched last month, which was like the lowest in a while. So wages are going up. I think they went up like a third of a percent. And for the year, it's up just 4.5%. So wages are going up and more people are working. It feels like a pretty strong economy out there in the labor force, right?
Right. But most people say, no, we need a bad jobs report. We need we need really bad jobs report. We need a lot of layoffs. We need earnings to be bad. We need the economy to be bad so the Fed can lower rates so the economy can get better and interest rates go down.
You know what it is, Derek? Those are all the folks that have been like predicting a recession, right? That are, I mean, I still hear people today in the, on the morning, you know, shows and stuff, whether it's Squawk Box or it's on Bloomberg, there's still plenty of economists that said, yep, recession this year. I don't know what planet they're on. What are they looking at to think we're going to have a recession this year?
I don't know. I mean, so far it looks pretty good. But you and I both know that sometime, you know, jobs is when you start to see real unemployment and there's always this order of things that happen and employment's really the last domino to fall.
It is. It is the last shoe to drop. Yeah. That is true. That is true.
It creeps up on you. What I mean by that is like you don't see it. You say, oh, it's down. It's down. It's down. It's down. Like sometimes you see it spike right before a recession. But no, Jay, I mean, I don't know what they're looking at. I really don't. Yeah. Have you been in an airport lately?
Yeah.
It's packed, right?
Packed.
So businesses are spending money on travel. People are spending money like it's going out of style on, you know, if you look at hotel prices, like pick any, I'll challenge the audience here. Pick a hotel that you went to in the past, some vacation destination, and think about in your head how much you paid per night. And then look at the rate now. I'll bet you it's triple.
Triple? Whoa. I won't go triple, but it's up.
Well, I think it's up more. I think this stuff is up more, Jay. So, yeah, the economy seems to be doing good. Was there anything in this report that was bad? I mean, who knows if this gets revised down, but I don't know.
It was good. Goldilocks.
There was interesting. I will note Goldman Sachs had a chart out. And, you know, I mentioned the size of the labor force is growing. It looks like people are coming into the labor force. The size of the non-institutional population is rising. And that can happen a number of ways. One way is, so working age people, you have from one age to another, and it's the size of, you could have people pass away, unfortunately. You could have people age out of the brackets. You could have more people leaving the U.S. or more people coming in. Goldman Sachs had, they talked about net U.S. immigration is the highest it's been. It looks like, I mean, this goes back to 2001. I don't see any bars on here that are higher. They do break it down into, and this is on their chart, they have the total, and then they break it down to permanent residents, lawful permanent residents, authorized temporary immigrants, and unauthorized immigrants. And we'll kind of leave the commentary on that to other shows, but it's all up, Jay.
Yeah, no, the immigration is definitely up in the U.S. So when you think about, hey, going into the workforce, certainly there's more folks coming into the country. Yeah, I mean, according to this, the previous high looked like it was about 1.8 million. And this right now says we're at 2.5 million. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's like a trailing 12-month number. It can't be. Do you think that was 2023, that number that I'm looking at for the whole year?
If you look at it, says Goldman Sachs estimate using court case data with it, and it looks like there's some CBO, Congressional Budget Office estimates of some things. So I'd imagine it's backward looking, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. So, definitely backward looking. Well, I don't know if it's doing an estimate, but I would say, look, immigration into the U.S. is on the rise because there's jobs here, right? So, and it looks, I mean, that could be contributing to the number you know, where are these other folks coming from who want to work? You know, we had a drop in the workforce, certainly after the pandemic, right? A lot of people just decided not to come back to work. But now it looks like, you know, coming back up, you know?
Well, it's an interesting point because I think there are some people who might have been closer to retirement age and said, you know, I'm going to take early retirement. And maybe they've come back into the workforce or, you know, I mean, when the stimulus and a lot of the government stuff that was being, you know, they're,
I don't know. Most of the boomers I know that retired, stayed retired, they're pretty flush right now.
Yeah.
Even after 2022's market move, 2023 was good, 2024 seems strong. They're not feeling a lot of pressure to come back. So those early 60s, you know, mid-60s folks are...
But there were some that said, you know, I'm going to go be a poet instead of working, and you know, maybe they've come back into the workforce. I don't know. But this is all good. That's the bottom line. Like
boomer poets. Put that in the title of this
boomer. Boomer okay, poet. Hang on. I'm writing that down. Boomer poets. I don't know if we have any of this. All right. Let's switch to something on the markets. You had pointed this out to me, JP Morgan's guide to the market, at all time highs. And here you go. Take this one, Jay.
Yeah. So apparently, you know, we talked about this last week, and I'll repeat this point. When you invest on the day that the market's at an all-time high, like the day it's which is not today, which was not yesterday, which was last Friday, actually, if you invested on a day like that, historically speaking, you would make more than investing on any other day, 6 months, 1 year, 2 year, 3 years later. So if you invest any day and then look 1 year out versus investing on just the days when the market's at an all-time high, you actually have higher returns in that scenario. The other thing that I would add that I wanted to bring up is that almost 7% of the time the market is at an all-time high on any given day. Right? So that's a lot, right? I mean, we always talk about, and I've been, you know, obviously making a big deal about it this whole year while we've been doing the podcast. But, you know, it is not unusual to have all-time highs. It happens. The other thing about those all-time highs is they end up being a floor when there were pullbacks. Well, so you kind of watch for when markets have these kind of peaks and you watch for when the pullbacks occur. They end up like those really kind of notable peaks, previous peaks, end up being what we call support from a technical analysis perspective, would end up being support when there are pullbacks. So meaning that even if you buy at a high and the market goes up, the pullbacks will typically stop, can typically stop right at where a previous high was. So it almost has this kind of built-in mechanism of keeping itself high. Look, obviously, there's plenty of times where the market sells off more and you go through previous highs. That's how you have, you know, 10% corrections and bear markets of in excess of 20%. But I only bring this up because investing at all-time highs shouldn't, you know, a lot of people shy away from that because they're worried. We say you shouldn't be too worried to let the dynamics, you know, markets tend to go higher. So if you invest now, you go out 3 years, you know, 48% of the time, you know, markets are going to be higher than at least, sorry, the 48% return after a 3 year period is the average when you invest at all time highs. That's one of those data points that we like to just remind people, like markets generally go up. However, here's my however, Derek, If you still are concerned and you're like, I want to invest, but I don't want to invest at exactly the wrong time when the market's at an all-time high and I know it's going to sell off. If that's what you think, then you should hedge. And the beautiful thing about hedging is it's cheaper when the market is at an all-time high, right? Volatility is low. Options are cheaper. It just becomes more affordable. And we're looking at some of the most affordable hedges that have been out there, which also tells me no one's really fearful about the market up until 2 days ago. However, up until Wednesday or Thursday. But before that, look, investing and hedging gives you that comfort to get the upside participation, but also building in some protection at the same time. It's almost like the best of both worlds, if you ask me.
Yeah. I mean, someone in the audience is probably going to be like, well, okay, now do it. What if you bought it at a market low? Wouldn't you be better off? Well, probably, but the market doesn't spend that much time around, you know, all-time market lows. In fact, if we made a new 3 year low today, well, market's closed. Monday, we make a 3 year low, you're still not at an all time low. I hope people are grasping what I'm saying there, Jay. Like,
that would be something, right? To go back and hit the low of
1870, 1700 or something, you know?
And I mean, I'm just looking. Oh, right. But if I look back at 2022, like if you said 3 years ago, right, it's 3,500, right? We're at 5,200 now in the S&P. So there's been, that would be quite the pullback. Should you invest there? Yeah. I mean, if you're waiting for that though, you could be waiting a long time.
Yeah. But you get my point. I mean, if we made, and by the way, it's been a whole week without an all-time high. Shut the doors, Jay. Like, bat down the hatches. It's a
disaster. I don't know how we're going to survive. Kidding.
But I mean, you know, look, if you make an all-time high today or Monday, okay, that's the highest the market has ever been. The S&P 500. That's the highest it's ever been. If you can't really make an all-time low unless you go to zero. I hope people are grasping what I'm saying there. Like it, the markets don't spend time around all-time lows. It doesn't happen. You can do a cycle low. You can do a bear market low, but it just, all right, I'm done, Jay.
You're done.
Is that good?
Market timing stuff.
Okay. Here's another thing. Also from JP Morgan's Guide to the Markets, S&P 500 returns around the end of a Fed hiking cycle. This is the percent price return and indexed to zero, which means regardless of which year you're looking at, you sort of say, let me go a year before the last hike. And what are the returns of the S&P 500? Then we sort of have in this graph, the zero is the last hike. The last time they hiked interest rates is what I'm referring to. And then you look at 3, 6, 9, 12, all the way out to 24 months. How did the market do? And I would say, Jay, that 2022 to 2023, we are about seven or 8 months since our last hike. And the markets on a, you know, price return are up, what, like 15% since then?
Since that last hike, yep.
And it's tracking about the same distance as other periods when most of these, the market was higher. The exception is 99, 2000. When the market was low 24 months later. So like the Fed just has to stop hiking. It doesn't even say anything about whether hikes, you know, how much was cut. So yeah, Jay, it seems like it's tracking.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's tracking. And actually there's, you know, three other periods that are better than what we're going through now. So in other words, if you think that this is a unique phenomenon we're going through with what the market is, what has happened since the last Fed hike, it's really not. This is pretty typical. Actually, it's probably slightly under the average for when the market ends up going up. Of course, like you just said, the 99 to 2000 decline is different here. But, you know, if you follow this through, there's plenty of times where the market is up, you know, 30% from the time that the Fed had the last hike 2 years later. Right. So, again, my point is it's not unusual. The strong market that we've had is not unusual when you consider the Fed cycle and you look at the other times where they stopped raising. Just stop raising seems to be in and of itself a catalyst for the market to appreciate. And of course, the Fed has stopped raising. Like you said, 8 or 9 months it's been since they've had the last raise.
I mean, really, all right, I'm done with the Fed. I'm done. I'm done talking about them. I was going to say something. I'm not going to say it.
All right.
10-year treasury, different situation. And so this is the 10-year treasury. Let's see. Yeah, the total return or the 10-year treasury return. So if you owned, let's say, you bought a 10-year treasury bond, how much have you made or lost? Most cycle, so they tend to be flat to down into the last hike. And then most of the cycles, the 10-year treasury, it would be higher in price than it was when, you know, at zero. This year, though, we are flat. Like, we're not tracking the same area as the other ones. So this is a little different. I mean, Jay, obviously, the expectations for the Fed cuts have gone down. But we have this dynamic where the 10-year treasury, the 30-year treasury, at different points in the curve are acting differently. And as you have more growth, and I've always said this, the 10-year is in the longer parts of the curve are more of a proxy on the estimated growth. And if you look at 10-year periods of nominal GDP growth and you looked at the 10-year treasury yield, they're sort of similar. So it seems like we have growth. We have a reduction in the expectations for future interest rates. In fact, rates have gone up on the 10-year. So this is a little different. And bonds underperformed last couple of years. They are underperforming the markets again.
Yeah, you're right. This is not what the bond market is doing is not typical, right? It feels like we're waiting for bonds to appreciate here since the last cut. If you look historically, you know, on average, bonds will be up what I'm just going to round this to maybe like 12-13% by this time. The 10-year would appreciate by that much. And right now it's flat. So it's definitely kind of forming its new path here. On average, after 24 months, it looks like it's almost 20%, right? Is kind of the average appreciation of the 10-year right. bond. So that probably has always been accompanied by rate cuts. And I know, you know, in those periods, there are rate cuts. So, but we haven't had any yet. And it feels like while the Fed is continuing to, you know, stand tight on its cutting, it looks like the market has left bonds as fairly, you know, unchanged. And this is 10-year return. So, Derek, I would say that includes the yield itself, right?
Correct.
Yeah. So actually bonds are down in value because they've had at least 4.5%, 4.3% yield here. So, yeah, bonds are underperforming here. So this is the fixed income market is definitely not acting as it had in the past after the Fed stopped raising.
This also goes to bond. I almost feel bad for people who just said, I'm going to use bonds as a hedge because they didn't, you know, it was an interest rate going up, bonds getting, I mean, AGG, I don't know when that's going to make a new high, the U.S. aggregate bond index on a total return basis. I mean, it's a little better because you have the yield versus the price, but it's going to be a bit. If you bought a 30-year treasury right before interest rates went up, it could be quite, I mean, it might be 20 something years before you get back to break even on that one.
That's break even.
So, yeah, I mean, bonds really haven't done what people thought they were. Of course, if you read my book, Broken Pie Chart, I did have a whole chapter on why bonds' future performance can't possibly match the past. So, can I just say I'm the guy who called this the bond market problem?
I mean, really, the Broken Pie Chart. What a great gift. Can they get that on Amazon? Can they find that?
The nice thing is they can get that book, Broken Pie Chart, on Amazon. And you pair it with your book, Jay, Buy and Hedge. And, you know, I just got to think, you might have missed the Easter holiday. But, you know, we have Memorial Day coming up. We have, well, that's a little far off. What do we have in April? That's weird. We don't have anything in April, do we?
Wow. It's usually that's when you get the Easter. But we had, you know, St. Patrick's Day and Easter and St. Patrick's Day is a big holiday in my house.
Well, I mean, but we need people to buy these going forward for gifts.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, why not? Like, it's you don't need a reason. It's okay. You can buy it today.
Yes. Yeah.
It's not changing. It's good.
No, that's right.
You don't miss anything.
All right. Another thing that caught me by surprise was, this is also JP Morgan's guide to the market, MSCI developed markets. So basically Europe. Against the MSCI USA relative performance. So think about the S&P versus developed Europe, pretty much, or developed markets, foreign markets. And it was 14.2 years consecutive of outperformance of the US market. This one crept up on me, I'll be honest with you, Jay. Last 2.3 years, according to JP Morgan's Guide to the Market, the developed foreign markets have outperformed the U.S. market. Like, I did a double take on this one.
Yeah, you know, Derek, I was thinking about it too. When I saw it, I was like, really? Developed to outperform the U.S.? Japan is developed, isn't it?
Oh, there you go.
It's Japan. It's not Europe. So I don't know the weighting on this, but it has to be because Japan is having a very strong market, right? So I think it's probably Japan that's causing this developed market index to show outperformance against the U.S., but That's my initial reaction to this. But it is certainly surprising because for a long time, you know, especially with the conflict that's going on in Europe, there's been, you know, a lot of concern about the underperformance of of those markets. So when we both saw this, it was like, really? So, but I think it's Japan. I think that's probably the driver of this.
That's right. Speaking of all-time highs.
Yeah.
Japan. I don't get to talk. I already took my Japan allotment of time. I can talk about that market in a past one. So we'll move on. And all right, let's talk a little inflation. And let's do inflation first and look at it from a different point of view. And then we'll kind of get to some volatility stuff and some option stuff that I know people like. So if I was to ask you, Jay, how much is the most recent report, if we look at food or consumer price index, food at home, a 12-month change, what do you think the inflation, the year-over-year inflation rate is?
Like the year-over-year food change?
Yeah. Do you know what it is?
Look, food had that big spike. I feel like it's loving. I don't know. I'm going to say 2-3% change.
Okay.
3%.
You're very, very close. 1% was the latest reading in February. So meaning the CPI for food at home, that's like you shop for groceries and you eat it at home, not out at a restaurant. It's, you know, it was 13.5% in August 22, meaning year over year. How much did the basket of stuff cost a year ago? How much does it cost today? Okay, so 1% year over year. Like I was talking to some people in you know, where I live in the neighborhood and stuff, and they were sort of complaining about just how high and how expensive things are. And it's just this weird dichotomy between when we see these numbers year over year, it's like, oh, it's falling. But then you look, this is in the Wall Street Journal. Wall Street Journal had a piece and they said cooking oil since 2019 up plus 54%, beef up 51%, fruit snacks, shapes. I don't know what that is, but okay, up 77%. Mayonnaise up 50%.
I don't know what a fruit shape is.
Up 51%.
All these are up 50+%.
Yes.
That is a lot. I don't think it's a surprise to anybody that food costs have gone up. If you got into a restaurant, you've seen prices have gone up too. I think, and I'm paying like $15 for a sandwich at the sandwich shop in my office building, right? It's just everything has gone up. And I don't blame them. They're paying more for cost of sales, right? Food costs has all gone up. This is obviously a huge driver of it. And I know this is food at home, but the stuff in my sandwich is the same stuff as food at home, right? So it's one of those things that it's, I think the people that are kind of in touch with the day-to-day, you know, this day-to-day spending, you know, have realized that things went up and stayed up and they're still going up. You just told me we're still up 1%.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that's 1% on top of that, you know, that 15% that you said in August, right? It's even though the rate has declined, it's still going up. We're still paying more for everything. So, you know, as much as everyone's talking about, ooh, inflation is under control, we're never going back to 2019 prices. It's just not happening.
Yeah. I mean, if something cost $100 and now costs $170, you can say, oh, inflation only rose 1% year over year. Yeah, that's 1% on 170, not on 100. So, you know, if inflation is now at 1% rate of change, it doesn't mean it's only $101. It's, you know, 1% of $170. So it's 171.70, right? If I did my math right.
Right. So I know.
The other thing that the Wall Street Journal did is they had this nifty graph. So if you went onto the online WSJ site and you scroll down, They said, okay, if your grocery bill in 2019 was $100.30 and you scroll down and it said, well, to spend about the same, what would you have to take out? And they grayed out a bunch of stuff. So they grayed out like carrots and bananas and oat milk and I don't know, a bunch of stuff. The point is like, if you want to spend the same, you're getting less now. You're getting less.
Yeah. You're getting less. The good news is a little bit, as we started at the beginning of the conversation, wages are also up. Now they're not up to offset enough of this, but they
that's
are
a
up.
Spiral, Jay. Like it could, I'm not saying it's a wage spiral, but this is a vicious circle. How's that? Where you raise wages, so you have to raise prices. So you have to raise wages. I mean, California, I think in fast food is going to be $20. The government said you have to do $20 an hour.
I saw that. I did see that. Yeah. Well, we don't, I mean, I'm sure in your class you teach plenty about this, right? How, you know, and this is why, you know, you have things where the Fed tries to slow it all down, right? I know you didn't want to talk about the Fed anymore, but this is the point of why
they go there, rates
to slow down the economy and to stop this kind of cycle. And usually there's some pain associated with that, right? I mean, that was definitely what the Fed was trying to create directly. We joked a lot about that last year, where the Fed is trying to create pain in the economy so this kind of spiraling stops. They haven't been able to do it yet. They haven't been able to stop it. It's still going on between the wage growth and inflation. So,
did you see the AI generated thing where they have Powell speaking?
No.
And they have him say different stuff?
No.
It was something where I should have played it. I didn't queue it up, but he's like, we told you to stop buying NVIDIA. That didn't work. We told you to stop buying Bitcoin. That didn't work. Like, what do I got to do to make you stop doing all this? Like, stop buying, or we're going to really do something you don't like. I changed some of the language too. All right. Earnings, by the way.
Oh yeah. Let's talk about that.
So we always talk about in the end, it's earnings. So earnings over time tend to grow. You want earnings going up, and then how much the market goes up or down is a function of the multiple, how many times forward estimates or trailing, if you want to go that way, the market is. So it's this interesting thing right now where the forward PE ratio is stable, maybe a little bit down, even though the market just recently hit an all-time high on Friday. And the reason is because forward earnings estimates have continued to rise. And so as markets have gone up, if you take the market divided by the forward, 12-month, forward 2-year, forward 3-year, it's going up. I mean, we got a chart of it right here. Analysts are raising their estimates. I mean,
well, and we're about to go into earnings season,
yeah,
right? It's first week of April, second week of April. We're about to start seeing some earnings, and we'll see if this holds true. Typically, you can get a jump there as well. Everyone thinks, not everyone, there's a lot of chatter that the market is expensive, but the continued increase in expected earnings, justifies it. And, when you look back, you go, it wasn't expensive because it turns out we had a 16 PE when we actually realized, but the estimates didn't know how much was coming. So you can have earnings kind of grow into what the market is projecting. And that's not unusual. There's plenty of folks that'll say stocks are expensive here. I don't know. Looks like earnings growth is pretty robust, at least from the estimates perspective.
I think one of the things that a lot of people suffer from is this whole reversion to the mean. And where I'm going with this is profit margins. So you look at the net profit margins on the S&P right now. And I go back and I say, if I'm going to compare the net profit margin now, we have many more technology companies. And look, I don't know where the market's going. I don't know if it's overvalued, undervalued. If you want to buy it, you buy it. If you want to sell it, sell it. What I'm saying is 1970s, you had more industrial companies that are spending. If they want to create another dollar of income, they might have to do capital expenditures and buy more factories and tractors. I don't know why everybody needs a tractor, but why not? They buy tractors.
Who doesn't want a tractor?
I mean, these are a lot of tech heavy companies that have operating leverage that those other companies didn't have. So I can't tell you what's going to happen, but can we really compare the S&P now to the S&P in the 70s and 80s? I don't know.
Oh, no, the American business has definitely got a different mix. And, the big potential, cost reducer, I'm going to make that word up if that's the thing, is the potential of AI, right? There's, it's certainly projected to be one of those things that could cause companies to improve their margin even more by reducing their costs. And I don't know how much it helps, for John Deere or Caterpillar, on what they're selling, but I bet their production gets a little better from it. So it's one of those things that's, every once in a while you get this tech wave that will dramatically change the margin structure of companies. And that's, that seems to be the one that everyone's talking about right now.
There's a contrarian thing to say too, in that let's say some of these companies with higher interest rates, I'm talking about the zombie companies, that sort of suck capital out of the market, because really they're just in existence to make enough revenue to pay the interest cost on their debt. I wonder if some of those were to go away because of higher interest rate costs and capital got deployed more efficiently, that would also support a longer run, higher profit margins. I don't know. It's a little contrarian. I'll tell you if I'm right or not in 5 years. How's that? Right.
So yeah, 5 years. I got to wait 5 years. Okay.
That's 5 years. That's right. All right. Here's what we don't have to wait for. People, by the way, can, you know, if you have questions about how we invest or you want to see how we can help you, or you just want to tell us how good the podcast is, we like getting those. Derek.Moore@ZegaFinancial.com. That's DEREK.MOORE. At Z as in zebra, E as in Eddie, G as in George, A as in apple. Financials up to you to spell correctly. Jay, can we take a listener question this week? Deals with options.
Yeah, I'd love it.
Andres said, you know, thanks. Been learning a lot from you guys. And his question is, how do I know when I'm paying the right price for a call or a put? Is there an exact percentage of the stock when it is not volatile? Jay, I would remind, kind of set the stage, and you and I can riff on this a bit. An options price is determined by where the underlying stock is, where the strike price is, what interest rates are, how much time to expiration there is, and really the more complicated one is, what does the options market expect on a forward basis for how much an underlying can move? And, you know, kind of setting the stage there, you think about how something is priced. Is it in the money, out of the money? But Jay, it's a good question from Andres. So I'll let you go first.
Okay. So the last part we like to call volatility, right? The expected move. We call that the implied volatility, right? You named all the factors that go into pricing of an option. I will add one more. Sometimes a dividend may matter in there.
Yeah, there you go. Agreed.
There's a lot of things when it comes to an option that are absolutely known, right? You know the underlying price, right? You know the strike price, so you know the difference. That's just math. There's nothing. Okay, that's easy. That's subtraction. You know how much time there is left, right? Number of days till expiration. Okay, that's a known quantity. The interest rates are a known quantity, one that didn't matter for a long, long time, and now it does. But the one that you don't know, the one you really don't know, the one that is more, I'm going to say, you know, representative of your kind of emotion in the option price is volatility, right? And that is, so how do you know, like, hey, is a stock priced properly based on its volatility? Well, there's two things that you can look at, right? What has happened in the past? What's been the historical volatility, right? That's almost every charting system you use will let you choose historical volatility. So you can look at what it's done in the past, how much it's moved. But the bigger one is, what are the upcoming events? Are there earnings? Is there a big product release? Is there a potential merger? Things like that, that'll find their way into the option price. And that, to me, is the one that you just don't know. So what you want to do, almost every option chain will show you kind of the average volatility for that expiration. You could look at that. Think about this, and I don't want to get in, and I'll leave it to you, Derek, if you want to get into the statistical representation of volatility. But the more you think an option could move, the more you should be willing to pay for it. And when I say the option move, the underlying price move, right? The more you think there's a chance that a stock is going to move, you know, quite a bit, you're going to have to pay up for that. Or if you're a seller of options, you're going to get more premium for that. You know, we manage a bunch of ETFs. Some of them sell options, some of them buy options. It all depends what the strategy is. And the way I always look at that is, I look at the price. Do I think that's where the market is going to go? And am I going to get paid for that? Because you still have to have an outlook when you're getting into an option, right? Whether you're bullish or bearish, you still have to have an outlook. Where's the market going to go? So still use that, you know, that idea of the price, right? If I'm going to talk about Apple for a second, Apple is 170 right now, and that seems fairly low compared to what it's looked at over the last, you know, year or so. I think if you're looking at that, you may say, okay, do I have a thesis that Apple's going to go lower, or do I have a thesis that it's, you know, it's bottomed, right? It's kind of hitting that level that it was back in, you know, October, and late November of last year. Is that the bottom? So let's say you think that's the bottom. You then got to ask yourself, okay, how much am I willing to pay for the upside and where do I think it's going to go? And that will find its way into the options market. And you can tell what the options market thinks is going to happen, right? If I was to look at, you know, Apple a month out, and I would look at, say, the May 3rd options, right? If you just, again, look at what's your break-even movement on the options when it comes to Apple, you know, it actually, you know, the market is predicting a 9-point move in Apple over the next month. So you say to yourself, okay, do I think it's going to go up 9 or not? Then you could buy that call and do the determination if that's going to be profitable or not. But the market is telling you, it could be 179. It could be 160. You don't know, but that's kind of the range. So I know it's a long-winded answer here. Am I paying too much or am I not getting enough money for the options? I think it's have your own outlook and take a look at where your break-evens are. If you're a directional player, then there you go. If the market, you know, the chance that Apple moves 9 and you want to buy a call for $5 and the market is right and it goes up 9 points, great. You'll end up making money on that call. If the market goes down, then you've forfeited that. I do like using options in this scenario to define my risk, though, right? Use notional. We've talked about this in the past. It's a whole nother piece about not getting yourself. Don't spend all your money. Spend your money as if you bought the stock, right? Even though an option costs you $5, make it feel like it costs you $170 per share. And that'll keep you from blowing yourself up and getting yourself too leveraged accidentally.
Yeah, I mean, so let's drill down on that for a second, because let's say you're using Apple, right? So $170. So if you bought 100 shares, you would spend what? You'd spend $17,000. Yeah. So, and the temptation for especially new options trader is I can buy the option for a few dollars. So I'll spend $17,000 on options. No. So because one option is essentially, like you said, if you buy an at the money option or around the money, you're kind of long the same 100 shares because you control but don't own 100 shares for every one contract that you have. I think that's one of the lessons that all of us, and I say I'm pointing at me and you too, have to learn as far as, you know, options are cheap, but it's representing something. You're still
controlling. Yeah, they control quite a bit, right? You could spend $500 to control 100 shares, or you could spend $17,000 to control 100 shares over the next month. The thing is, though, when you spend the $17,000, the only way you could lose it all is if Apple went to zero. With the options, when you spend that $500, if the market's flat, you'll lose all $500 mm-hmm. on a long call, right? Because that'll decay to zero. So you still need movement in your favor, right? So it's just be careful when you're just, you know, using outright long options. We like to use spreads to cut down on that price, but still it doesn't matter. The point is understand your sizing and the amount that you're controlling. And always think about your worst case scenario, right? For you to get your money back when you spend $5 on a 170 call means your break even is 175. So Apple has to go up, you know, 3% just for you to break even with what you spent. But if you bought the shares, Derek, you'd make 3%, but you'd cost you a lot more to do it. So there are ways to kind of offset that with synthetics, and I won't get into the depth of that.
No, that's let's why not you call get into
us.
Those.
No, that's why you call us. We help you. But it's one of those things that I, you know, look at the volatility on Apple. It's projecting a 9-point move. It's got a volatility of about 27%. You know, that tells use the options to help you predict where the market is going to go. And by the way, I believe we don't get earnings in there. So that's before earnings. Earnings look like they're on May 13th. So let's do a little, hey, event is coming. What if I look at the May 17th options, right? So that's after earnings. In that scenario, so only at two more weeks, the market is going to charge you double. The market is expecting a move. Actually, it's not double, Derek. Now that I'm looking at it, it's charging you $12 instead on the 170. So the market isn't predicting too much of a move, even around earnings for Apple. That's kind of interesting, that volatility staying low on that. We can unpack that a little later, maybe next week. We can talk more about
it. Yeah, as we get more into earnings. Yeah.
So not that much more to get, you know, to directionally get, you know, yourself you know, involved in Apple adding to the earnings move. Like Apple at once, you know, what do I know, right? But, you know, when we look at Apple, not that we know which way it's going to go, but, you know, this is a pretty interesting level for it. If it doesn't hold, you know, look out below. But has it bounced off here in the past? Yeah, a couple times.
Just in general, if you're looking at, I'm going to make up a stock, Jay. I know you like the fake stocks. U.S. consolidated dryer lint. Sounds like it wouldn't be volatile at all. Like, who would buy dryer lint from you? If you're buying options on that, the volatility is going to be lower. They're going to be cheap. And is that cheapness, is that a better buy than buying an at-the-money call or put on NVIDIA that are way more expensive? Not necessarily, because like you said, it's just a forward estimate of how much volatility, how much range is going to happen in those underlyings. So,
yeah, and you could look historically what it's done,
yeah,
right? What's been the move? Look at the historical volatility and then decide if you think it's cheap or expensive.
You don't like my company, U.S. Consolidated Dryer Lint?
Well, I'm trying to think of a use for the consolidated dryer lint, but generally I feel like maybe you could use it for like fake snow. Maybe you could use it if you're, you know, you want to kind of jam up somebody's.
We're going to get the licensing problem there.
I stopped it. No Motley Crue today. Sorry.
All right. Let's talk about VIX though. Thanks Andres for the question. VIX today or VIX yesterday, the highest close, I think since November 2nd. We only close, what do we close? High 16 handle, right? And then today it came back down. It's been, to your point, by the way, I won't even bring up what you appeared on.
Let's bring it up. Let's talk about how brilliant Jay can be when he goes on TV and media.
Yeah. So you went on to the TD Network.
It's now called the Schwab Network, by the way.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's not the TD Network. Schwab Network, of course. So you're on there with the host Oliver and, you know, it was, you go on those things and it's like, okay, here's an example of a trade. And I think you showed how you could zero cost collar. That's always an interesting trade. A couple other things. And you talked about the volatility regime and you and I have been saying, you know, we're in a lower volatility regime. And what did you say you thought the VIX handle could go to, Jay?
I said I wouldn't be surprised mm-hmm. that at some point this year we'd see a 10 handle on the VIX.
Okay. And you didn't say it's going there. You just said it. You wouldn't be surprised.
I said I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah. I think that's fair.
Guess what it did the very next day?
It went
from 14 to 16. It went the very next day.
Yeah.
Well, look, I still think I would say we're still probably in that lower volatility regime. I mean, today we closed above 16 again. That's 2 days in a row. 16 is an interesting number, right? 16. Well, Derek, you do a better job of explaining what a VIX 16 means. What does it mean?
Well, it's square root of time is 252 days in a year. And if you take the square root of 252, it's about 15.875. You round it up, you call it the rule of 16. So a 16 volatility.
Start to expect a 1% move every day.
Yeah, that's the one standard deviation expected move is about 1%, you know, range there.
Yep. So that's an interesting number. And it didn't quite get below. It tried to get below it today, but it didn't quite get below it. So, yeah, so that's a perfect example of, look, I mean, I love going on and talking in front of a bunch of people. And I got a few people who reached out to me and said, really, you think a 10 handle? And I think, yeah, I still think it's possible for us to see that. I do think we have this, you know, the market has been, you know, really tight and it's been low volatility. I don't mind the higher volatility, but, you know, when we look at some of the other data points like the VVIX that we track, and we've talked about that in the past, I still think we could see lower volatility. We certainly aren't getting it this week, though. So, you know, I couldn't ask for a better time to be wrong, I guess, about that. Just get it over with.
But think about it this way. You know, you watch like, I don't know, the March Madness, you know, all those guys in the studio. They're like, I think, you know, such and such university is going to win by 50 points. Or I think, you know, San Jose State via Ohio, via Miami is going to, you know, I'm making up these names. They're going to win. Like no one ever goes back and looks at what those guys said.
You tell me it's okay. Like you're giving me an out, Derek.
No, but if it did, then you go on and you say the guy who said, called correctly the VIX at 10. That's why people throw out predictions. You just keep throwing them out. You'll be right once in a while, right?
Every once in a while, I'll be right. Clearly, only if it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So let's also talk about what else is going on in the volatility market. So we've been kind of looking at low volatility movements, and even with the kind of the sell off, you know, on Thursday, I think it was like a 1.4% move. By the way, it was almost a 2% move because we were up pretty much high.
It was that swing. Yeah,
it was a good intraday swing. And again, today I think we came up a little lighter than what we could have seen from that kind of a move, but it was still over 1%. So we start getting into these, you know, kind of wider range days that could kind of predicate, you know, a potential, you know, notable pullback. I'm not saying a 10% correction, but, you know, it could be. But look, I mean, when I still look at the cost to putting on protection, like I still, you know, it's still the right thing to do because you don't know when you're going to get that sell off. Right. And if you want to capitalize on that, there you go. I think, Derek, I don't think we're out of the low volatility regime. We're going to have fluctuations. It wouldn't be unrealistic to still see a VIX, you know, hit a 30 or a 25, but probably doesn't last there very long. Just if you, that's the characteristic of a low volatility regime. So if you're a seller of options and you may get a few opportunities in the near term, but you know, the way I look at it, I think continues to kind of decline and stay tight.
By the way, I don't know if you noticed all the candlestick chartists out there. You know, we had an outside day and we had an inside day on consecutive days.
Inside day. Yeah. So what is an inside day? So inside day is when the high and the low are inside of the high and the low or the range of the previous day, right?
But we followed totally, it engulfing the previous day.
Yeah.
Engulfing meaning the high and the low engulf the high and the low of the previous day.
And generally, that is considered to be kind of a consolidation phase. And you get multiple inside days, it can be considered a reversal. So it could also be one of those things that we pull another one of the, you get an inside day on Monday, you know, maybe start to look out, maybe the market's going to kind of go back and retest that 5,000 level. Derek, remind me again where our high and low numbers were when we were saying which one was going to hit.
Oh, I think you said, what did I say, 5,400?
I think you did, and I don't know where I think I went as low as 4,900. So we, you know, I may get a shot on the downside. By the way, I realize I'm talking out of both sides of my face because I just said low volatility, but to test, you know, to have a 300-point drop on the S&P, well, it wouldn't even be 10%. But, you know, to go from the 5260 high down to 4,900, yeah, it's 350 points, not 10%, but a little more than 5.
Look, I love the fact that we talk about this and we're so sort of transparent and honest that we fully admit we don't know with real certainty which way the market's going to go. It's why we buy, we hedge, we buffer, we sell volatility, we do different stuff. But it's like, this is what it kills me though. And people go on TV or they make these predictions like it's certainty. Like nobody knows. They really don't. Remember, 29 out of 30 economists, leading economists said we'd have a recession in 2023. The best economist in the world. Nobody knows, Jay.
I agree. I don't know.
I don't know.
By the way, it doesn't impact our trading.
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't impact the way we invest, right? So, I mean, this is fun jargon because everyone wants to know what the market's going to do. But for us, we definitely are longer term. We buy, we hedge. You want to do alternative income? Great. We got some stuff for that. But there's all a regime and discipline that we follow with all of those models, right? So we don't have to be right. I'll tell you, I think I told you this, Derek. When I'm going to go back to like 2013, right, when we were first talking about you coming over. And you said, Jay, like, why did you come up with some of these strategies? And I told you, this is my answer. I said, I needed strategies to work without me having to be right about the market, right? Like I just needed stuff that worked in general without having to predict the market was going to go up or down. So we're not making those predictions, of course. We're just kind of observing. It's fun to talk about it. But the way we invest is not based on these kind of short-term moves. We look more at the broader trends.
All right, Jay. I think we've beaten up the market and the Fed enough. Do you have any recommendations this week?
So I watched a good little short on Apple about Steve Martin. It's 2.5 hours, 45 minutes.
You were saying on Apple, the company.
No, on the Apple TV.
How is Steve Martin involved with Apple?
Apple TV. Okay. Apple TV. Well, clearly he's involved with Apple now because he's on Apple TV. So it was a special that was just kind of a 2-episode thing, but they were, you know, an hour and a half each. One was kind of the pre-movie Steve Martin years and then the post-movie Steve Martin years. I thought it was really great. I'm a big Steve Martin fan. I remembered him on SNL those early years. I had the King Tut album, right? His stand-up album. Mm. I had that when I was a kid. So I remember all of that. And so you've watched him through the years and he just kind of talks about how he transitioned. And, you know, at one point he had like the number one album. At one point, it was like, really? A comedian had the number one album. So I thought it was really great. So if you like Steve Martin, I would recommend watching that. It was enjoyable.
I have two recommendations. First is, Jay, I know you're a huge Florida Panther fan, the hockey team.
We have a hockey team.
Come on. You really have to go. They're good.
Okay.
So it's the last basically week and a half. Of the, I think, final week of the season. So playoff jockeying in NHL.
Wait, there's like, we're in playoffs?
Well another
I'm
week.
I'm not kidding. No, we can't be in hockey playoffs.
No, we've got another week and then we'll be in the playoffs. That's it. I
didn't even know the season started.
Oh, for God's sakes. So,
sorry.
My recommendation is hockey playoffs are absolutely tremendous. By the way, the other night, Rangers Devils at Madison Square Garden, the puck drops and immediately, all five skaters on each team on the ice.
I saw that.
Their gloves and fought.
Just have it out. I saw that.
Yeah. It's like, it reminds me of 1980s or 70s. So that's one of my recommendations. And I don't know why. What's that?
Slapshot.
Oh, the movie.
Movie Slapshot.
Paul Newman.
Recommendation. I think we've recommended that in the past.
The Hanson brothers.
Paul Newman. Great movie.
That was a great movie.
Fun movie.
But you should really go to a playoff game this year.
In Florida?
You have a team on the east coast of Florida. It's called the Florida Panthers. They are in Sunrise, Florida. So that's what? Up against the Everglades, right?
I'm sure somebody I know might know. So we'll okay.
You need go. Like, do I need to
hockey games are great to go, but I joke about this, right? But hockey games I enjoy much more in person than on TV.
Well, last year, your team, Florida Panthers, were in the Stanley Cup Finals and lost.
I'm still a Jersey Devil guy. Sorry.
I know. I mean, I'm a Rangers first, but I root for the Devils. So, all right. So that's watch hockey and watch the playoffs. The other thing I have, you'll love this. I don't know how I found this. On Netflix, it's a movie called The Wages of Fear. And I'm just going to read you the description. She's an NGO worker who knows the desert like no other. He's a former bodyguard who needs to make amends. Together, can they avert a deadly disaster? This was.
That's a hard pitch today on the Netflix.
It was entertaining. I liked it. So basically, it was a French movie, but the way Netflix does it, like they overdub the English speaking, so you really don't know. Like if you just watched it and you didn't know, you'd be like, oh, okay. Maybe the sound just off a tiny bit, but I was sort of entertained by it. They basically got to drive a truck filled with explosives across the desert. And it's a little dangerous doing that. So there you go.
Okay.
Number 9 movie in movies today on Netflix. So other people, it's not just me, Jay. Other people like the movie.
Okay. I'll have to check that one out.
All right. Well, that's it. I think that's it, Jay.
Derek, great talking to you today.
All right. Thanks, Jay. We'll see everyone next week. Bye.